What does John's gospel have to say about the Christian life? Famously, John tells us why he wrote at the end of his gospel. He says that he wrote so that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. We can easily read John's gospel and think that it is only about understanding who Jesus is, believing in him, important that those are, but we might not think that John's gospel is a rich resource for living the Christian life and thinking about Christian ethics. In today's episode, I'm joined by Tom Habib, lecturer in New Testament at Moore College, and he's going to help us to think about what it means to live the Christian life from the perspective of John's gospel. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to another podcast episode for the Center for Christian Living. My name is Peter Orr. Chase is still on study leave and we're looking forward to reading what he's working on. But I have another colleague with me today. Tom Habib teaches New Testament and Greek at Moore College. And we're going to talk today about John's gospel and what John's gospel has to say in the realm of Christian ethics and the Christian life. But before we did that, I thought we'd get to know Tom a little bit. Tom, can you tell us who's in your family and how you became a Christian?
Sure. Hi, Pete. Well, my family, I'm married to Jess, and we have three young children who are 8, 6, and 4, so they keep us very busy. How did I become a Christian? Well, I was invited to a youth group when I was a teenager, and that's where I first started reading the Bible and learning about Jesus. And it was really through that process of reading the Bible and getting to know Jesus in his word that I came to love him and to see that he loved me. And yeah, his spirit did his work of calling me to Christ. It was over a long period of time, but that's the short answer.
That's wonderful. One of the joys of this year for me, Tom, was teaching John's gospel with you in the first semester. It's such a great thing to do with our students here. We open up John's gospel and we dig into it. John's gospel is one of the sort of richest New Testament books in terms of pointing us to Jesus and helping us to think about Jesus' relationship, the Son with the Father. And, you know, John tells us at the end that he's written the gospel so that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And so we might think that John's gospel is not necessarily a book that we would go to if we wanted to think about ethics, living as a Christian in the world. We might more naturally go to Matthew's gospel with the Sermon on the Mount, or we might go to Paul's letters. So you did your PhD on John's gospel. You've thought about it a lot. And I know that you do think that it has a lot to say on the Christian life. So help us to think through the place of John's gospel in Christian ethics.
Yeah, sure. So I actually think it's a fair question at first, because the normal ways that we look for God's teaching on how we should live our lives, we don't immediately see in John's gospel. So there is no Sermon on the Mount. There is no Good Samaritan parable. There is no list of virtues and vices that Paul gives us. And so when we read through John, it can feel like there's not as much in John on how we should live our life. And then, of course, it seems like John is just very repetitive. He has one theme and he's drilling it into us, and that is believe, 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 and you'll have life. And I think we can even feel that sometimes when we have sermon series on this, or we're reading it ourselves and we're thinking, okay, what's the application for today? Well, believe, that's the application for today. So it's definitely understandable why we can think that. Actually, I thought it'd be good to read a quote from an American scholar named J.T. Sanders. I think this was probably the harshest and completely unfair, but it sums up the view that John has no ethics. This is what he says. Here is not a Christianity that considers that loving is the same as fulfilling the law, like Paul, or that the Good Samaritan parable represents a demand, like Luke, to stop and render even first aid to the man who has been robbed, beaten, and left there for dead. Johannine Christianity is interested only in whether he believes. Are you saved, brother? The Johannine Christian asks the man bleeding to death on the side of the road. Are you concerned about your soul? Do you believe that Jesus is the one who came down from God? If you believe, you'll have eternal life, promises the Johannine Christian, while the dying man's blood stains the ground.
You've painted an extreme picture there, but you know, it is true. John says an awful lot about belief and faith, and it's one of the most helpful books in the New Testament to learn about faith, but does it do more than that?
Yeah, so I think part of the problem is where we look for instructions on the Christian life, especially where we look for it today. We look for it in lists and in rules. And in the ancient world, that's not primarily how they taught people how to live good or virtuous lives, especially in Greco-Roman literature, but also in Jewish literature as well across the ancient world. The way that you taught people how to live was by giving them examples. You showed them how to live a virtuous life by giving the examples of people who did live virtuous lives, and then you were to imitate those lives. I think a really good example of that would be Plutarch's lives. Plutarch was a Greek Middle Platonist who wanted to instruct people on how to live. And so what did he do? Well, he told stories about famous Greek and Roman leaders and philosophers and what their lives were like so that we would learn from them. And that was the whole point. And he actually wrote, that's why he created these lives. I think in a similar way, when we come to the Gospel of John, John has a lot to teach us about how to live our lives. But the primary form in which he teaches us that is by presenting Jesus as the one who we are to imitate. And of course, the other characters, if we can call them characters, they're real people who lived real lives and interacted with Jesus. But from a literary point of view, the characters in the gospel, they also are examples for us, either examples to imitate or examples to avoid. But certainly Jesus is presented to us as this primary example for us to imitate. And when you read through John's gospel, you come to see that imitation is actually at the very heart, not only of how we are to live our lives, but at the very heart of how we are to understand the relationship between God the Father and God the Son.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So what we're starting to see is that maybe the ethics, the Christian life aspect, and the theology, it's not as if they're two separate things in John's gospel. They're connected. Can you just tease out a little bit more for us? What do we imitate of Jesus? What aspects of his life do we imitate?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with the Father and the Son relationship. In John 5, Jesus tells us that the Father loves the Son by showing everything to the Son. And then the Son does everything that he has seen from his Father. John 5:19, whatever the Father does, the Son does these things likewise. So you have actually a picture of imitation in the relationship between the Father and the Son. The Son only does everything that the Father does. It is a perfect imitation, if you will, of the Father. But then this model is actually used as the model of discipleship, how we are to live our lives as we imitate Christ. So in John 15, verses 9 to 12, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. And my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. So the Son does everything he sees from the Father, but now Jesus calls for us to imitate the Son, to do what he commands. And what is his command? Well, his command is that we love one another. And we are to love each other as Christ has loved us. And there's that imitation. What is it of Jesus in particular that we imitate? We imitate his love for us and a love that is exemplified in his death. And we see this most clearly, I think, this idea of imitation at the beginning of the Upper Room discourse in the second half of John's Gospel, when Jesus washes his disciples' feet. He says in John 13, verse 14, now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set for you an example that you should do as I have done. So Jesus shows us, first of all, by doing it himself. He gets them to understand what it is that he's doing, and then he asks them to do it. Now, of course, what Jesus is getting them to do is not just wash each other's feet. This is not the primary thing that he wants them to imitate. That itself is an image of what Jesus is going on to do by dying on the cross for them. And so we are called to imitate the love that Jesus has shown for us and the service, the sacrificial service, even the shameful service that Jesus has shown to us. We are to now do that to one another in imitation of Christ.
Thanks, Tom. That's really helpful. Can you help us think, what does that actually look like for us today?
Yeah, so when we get down to sort of the practical application of imitating Jesus, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to physically die just like Jesus did. Even though Jesus does provide that model for us, that we lay down our life for our brothers and sisters, I think what we see when we get to, say, 1 John, the first epistle that John writes, what we actually see is a creative application of this model. So in 1 John chapter 3, verse 16, we get this very well-known verse. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. There it is. That's the imitation. That's what we are to do. But then, verse 17, if anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. So for John, imitating Christ as he laid down his life for us is actually done by providing materially for our brothers and sisters. And so this is an example of creative application. This was actually really common in the ancient world. In the ancient world, when people were held up as examples for us to imitate, no one ever thought that you needed to do exactly what they did. What was encouraged was rather that you extract the principle or the lesson from their life, and then you apply that creatively to your own life. And I think that's exactly what we see happening here in 1 John. We have the principle of sacrificial love, of putting others before ourselves, even to the point of pain or even to the point of shame. And then John gives us a practical application here in terms of, okay, well, if you have a brother or sister who's in need, provide for them materially. I mean, if you're not willing to do that, you're certainly not going to die for them, are you? And so what looks like only one command in John's gospel, lay down your life for others, actually becomes something that invades all of life, permeates through all of life.
In terms of thinking about how we do this in practice, is what you're saying just another way of saying, what would Jesus do? Is that essentially what John is calling us to do as we live our lives?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's actually a really important question because a whole strand of Christianity was kind of built on the idea that all Jesus did for us was provide an example. And that's the power of Jesus. That's the power of the gospel. He lived a good life. And if we just lived like him, then that would be great. And a lot of, I guess what we call liberal Christianity has really gone down that route of Jesus' death purely as an example. And I think what would Jesus do, even though it can be a helpful thing for us to think about in some ways, the problem with what would Jesus do is that it assumes that the only thing we need to do is look at Jesus and then do what he did. And I think what we have missing from that is the thing that John is banging on and on about in every single chapter, which is believe. Right, so you can't escape from believing in Jesus in John. And the reason for that is that the imitation of Jesus is entirely bound up with whether we believe in Jesus. It's all about whether we actually have a relationship with Jesus in the first place. And the way that John frames this primarily is the question of which family are you a part of? So right at the start of John's gospel, if you believe in Jesus, those who believe in Jesus are given the right to become children of God. Now, who do you imitate? Well, children imitate their parents. That's who you imitate. You imitate your father. And as we come into the family of God, we imitate the Son. We imitate Jesus. And I think John really draws this out in John chapter 8, when he's talking to the Judeans who assume that they are part of God's family. And John actually challenges them on whether they're part of God's family on the basis of what they do. So John 8:39, if you were Abraham's children, you would do what Abraham did. Then 8:41, but you're doing the works of your father, and their father being the devil. So if you belong to the devil, that is, if you don't trust in Jesus, if you haven't been liberated by the Son and you're still under slavery to sin and captivity of the devil, then you are inevitably going to imitate him and you're going to live a life that follows his example. But Jesus says in John 8 that the Son can set you free. The truth can set you free, that we can be liberated and brought into the household of the Son. And it's when we do that, that we can then start to imitate Jesus.
Going to take a break from our program so that I can tell you about our next in-person event, which is also online if you can't make it in person to Moore College. On the 18th of October, starting at 7:30, Mark Thompson,
principal of Moore College, will be talking about perseverance. This whole year, we've been thinking about Christian virtues. And the virtue that Mark will help us to think about is the virtue of perseverance. Christians can often be caught off guard by how difficult life can be. And there are all sorts of things, grief, relationship problems, hostilities from friends, colleagues, because we're Christians. And it's tempting to give up as a Christian or to doubt God's goodness. And yet the Bible encourages us to keep going in the midst of hardship. And the Bible reminds us that suffering is not a sign of God's absence or of his displeasure, but of his good presence. The Bible affirms that the storms of life we weather serve to refine our faith as we hope in his promises. Mark is going to help us to think through the idea of perseverance, what it means to keep going as a Christian, what resources the Bible gives us to keep going as a Christian. And it would be great to see you at the event. And if you can't make it, as I say, it'll be online. And the details are all on the CCL website. Looking forward to engaging with you in person or online.
Now let's get back to our program.
Can I just push you a little bit further on that? So this idea that, you know, if we are children of the devil, inevitably we will follow and imitate the devil. We become children of God through believing in Jesus. Can you just talk through what's the difference? So is there an inevitability in how we follow God? What place is our conscious imitation in that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think inevitability. I think possibility is probably a better word to use there. So I think when we're not brought into a relationship with God, when we don't put our trust in God and we're not liberated by the Son, then I think to a certain extent, we can't imitate Christ. We are not able to do that because we are under the slavery of the devil. That doesn't mean we can't ever do anything nice or that we can't ever be nice to our family or anything like that. But I think the imitation that Jesus requires, that sacrificial love that he calls for our brothers and sisters, I think that is something that is true of those who are born of God. That's what John says in his epistle. This is how we know if people are born of God or not. Now, for those who are born of God, you still can imitate the devil, which is really interesting. Again, this is sort of the challenge in 1 John as well, that you don't act like the devil. 1 John 3, do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. So we can still have a tendency to imitate our old master, if you will. But now that we've been brought into this new family, there's a fittingness to imitate the Son as well. And not just a fittingness, but a power as well. And I think this is where we really get into the idea in the Upper Room discourse of what it means to love Jesus and what it means to be empowered by his Spirit. So, yes, we enter into the family of God through faith, and we abide in this family, and we begin to imitate Jesus as we love him. And this is what Jesus says again and again, if you love me, you'll keep my commands. Whoever has my commands and keeps them is the one who loves me. Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. So what we actually see is our imitation of Jesus is dependent on how our relationship with Jesus is going. The more we love Jesus, the more we see how we've been loved by him and then changed by that, our love will result in imitation. And I think we actually see that in a human level with our families as well. Kids who love their parents tend to imitate them. Kids who hate their parents don't tend to imitate them. I think we need to believe in Christ. We enter into the family of God, but that is sustained, and our imitation grows more and more to be like Christ the more we love him. The only other thing then to say is that this is not done by our own power, and that when we come to believe in Jesus, Jesus says that God's Spirit is brought in us.
Thanks. That's very helpful. And I was going to ask you about the role of the Spirit. Obviously, the Spirit brings us into relationship, sustains us. I just wonder if you could tease out more what John says about the role of the Spirit, particularly in this idea of imitating Jesus, imitating God.
Yes. Well, as you said, the Spirit is the one who brings us into the family of God. John 3, we are born of the Spirit. And so the Spirit's work is first to bring us into this family. Secondly, we see that it is by the Spirit that the Son and the Father come to live in us. And so we have the indwelling presence of God within us by the Spirit. And I take it that it's only by this means that we then can imitate the Son. So the Spirit empowers us to imitate him. Now, if we really want to get down into details, how does he do that? Well, I think one of the primary ways that he does this is by recalling Christ for us. And this is what John tells us that the Spirit will do. He will glorify me because it is from me that he will receive what he will make known to you. All that belongs to the Father is mine. That is why I said the Spirit will receive from me what he will make known to you. The Spirit communicates Christ to us as we hear his words. And so, again, it really comes back to John's gospel. As you're reading John's gospel, and as you see Christ in the gospel, the Spirit is the one who makes Christ known to you, who reveals Christ. And as he reveals Christ, you imitate him and you can follow him. And so the Spirit is the one who recalls Christ. Recollection is a huge part of imitation. He recalls Christ for us so that we can imitate him. That was very much my story as I was reading the gospel as a teenager. I saw Christ. And I put my trust in him, and now begins that lifelong journey, very imperfect journey, over that lifelong journey of imitation as the Spirit recalls Christ for me.
That's so helpful, Tom. And just seeing how John's gospel, with his theology, with his view of Christ and his doctrine of salvation, these are all connected to how we live the Christian life. And it's just a reminder not to sort of compartmentalize these things. I wonder if we could just take a different tack at the moment, or not different, but related in terms of imitation more broadly. I know you've done quite a lot of work on characters in John's gospel. There are other characters. What's the role of the other characters, the minor characters, we might say, particularly in terms of this idea of imitation and the Christian life?
Yeah, I think that as evangelicals, especially here in Sydney, we are very wary of reading into the text things like characters as examples for us. And I think rightly, that's come from a good place. It's because we want to affirm that the scriptures are not just moral lessons for us, but they're about God, they're about Christ, and they point us to him and point us to put our trust in him. But I wonder if there's been an overcorrection there, because I think certainly in John's gospel, but all throughout the scriptures, both the Old Testament and New Testament, the characters there do provide us with moral examples. That might not be the only purpose of a passage. And certainly the scriptures ultimately are pointing us to Christ, but they are also teaching us how to live. And I think characters do play a big part in that. It's really important to notice that there are no perfect characters in the Bible except for Jesus. And so there's no perfect examples. But I think there's a lot that we can learn from these characters, both positive and negative. So I'll give you a few examples from John. I find the first disciples in John chapter 1 really interesting in how they respond to Jesus. When you take Andrew and the other disciple, the first ones who go from John and turn to Jesus, and what we're told about them, they're invited to come and see from the Lord, and they remain with Jesus for the whole day. I think that's an invitation for us as we come to consider Christ, and not just an invitation for those who aren't Christians, but an invitation for Christians as well. I think it's an invitation for meditation and for reflection on Christ. And I think they are a positive example for us of how we should live. Similarly, Nathanael, I think, is a really positive picture, even though we often think of him in a negative sense because he asks, what good can come from Nazareth? He is, again, somebody who comes and sees. And I think he is actually upheld as a true Israelite. Here is a picture of what someone from Israel should do in response to Jesus, as opposed to other Judeans in the story who reject Jesus. Then, of course, you get negative examples. The primary character in John that's a vehicle for the negative examples are who I would call the Judeans, sometimes called the Jews. And I think it's really important to notice that even though this character is primarily portrayed in a negative light, not all the Judeans are. In fact, by the time we get to John 11, we find that a lot of Judeans are believing in Jesus. Now, why is that? What's going on there? Well, I think what John is actually doing is he's undermining the whole idea that ethnicity is the primary factor in whether you're in the family of God. It doesn't matter if you're Judean or not. What matters is your faith response to Jesus. And so we have a group of people who, for some, they would see their ethnic identity as Judean as the primary factor in whether they're part of the covenant family of God. And yet, by the end of the gospel, we have some Judeans who are believing and other Judeans who aren't. We have a schism taking place that tears apart this ethnic category. So there's a lot that we can learn, not just even in terms of moral instruction, but in terms of theology, a lot we can learn from characters.
I've heard you talk about characters in terms of being complex characters. Do you want to say a little bit about that? That our tendency is to look for goodies and baddies, but yeah, the idea of a complex character.
Yeah, well, I think it is important to recognize that in the ancient world, there certainly was the sense of good goodies and baddies in a way that there isn't today. So what we love today, if we're watching a really good show on Netflix or something like that, we don't want a boring good character or a boring bad character. We want a really bad character that they make us love, that we really sympathize with and we think is great, because that's what life is like. Life is complicated and it's hard to judge. That's not so much what the ancient world was like. In the ancient world, the primary purpose of characters was, as I said, to teach virtue. And so you did need to be clear on whether somebody was acting virtuously or not. So on the one hand, I think we are meant to come with a little bit more of a clear framework of how is this character acting? Is what they're doing good in the moral framework of the gospel? Should we see this as a positive example or not? But then you do get characters where that's difficult to do. And one of those characters in John's gospel is Nicodemus. Very hard to pin down, partly because it's hard to know whether he believes in Jesus in the end or not. And what are you meant to do with him? This was a bit of the work that I did in my doctoral thesis. And what I argued in my thesis was that the purpose of complex characters in ancient characterization is different to modern complex characters. So in a modern novel, a character is complex because we cannot evaluate them. They're beyond evaluation because there is no clear normative moral framework. In the ancient world, complex characters explored complex moral ideas. So it didn't deny morality. It didn't deny that there was a good way of life, but it recognized that often there is a complexity to this. And I think when you come to Nicodemus, the complexity that's being explored is how can a person who is committed to being a Judean, that is committed to the law of Moses and committed to what the law teaches, how can they become somebody who trusts in Jesus? Are those two things at all compatible? And what we see as we go through the gospel is Nicodemus continually being faithful to the law of Moses and yet moving closer and closer to Christ. And we see other Judeans, especially Pharisees, who think that they're being faithful to the law of Moses, are not believing in Christ or rejecting Christ. And yet when you get to the end of the gospel, you see that morally they are not behaving in a way that is in line with what the law teaches. So John 18 and 19 is full of this rich irony as they claim to be defending the law, but they say, we have no king but Caesar, a complete blasphemy. And so they actually deny the law. And this is Jesus' point in John 8 as well, that you don't do what Abraham does. And so what you actually see in the complexity of Nicodemus is a coming together of two seemingly contradictory ideas, that someone can be both a Judean committed to the law of Moses and a follower of Jesus. They seem contradictory because the very reason why Jesus was put to death was because he was blaspheming. He was going against the law, he was breaking the Sabbath. And yet actually, someone who truly will follow the law will come to a belief in Jesus. So that's an example of how we can understand complex characterization in the Bible.
Brilliant. Tom, thank you so much. That's been really helpful. I'm very thankful to God for the opportunity to work on these things with you as we teach students here at Moore College, but also for the work that you've done and really helpful in helping us to see how John's gospel, John's letters, such a rich resource, not only for growing in our understanding of who God is, who Jesus is, but also how to live the Christian life. So thank you very much.
To benefit from more resources from the Center for Christian Living, please visit ccl.moore.edu.au, where you'll find a host of resources, including past podcast episodes, videos from our live events, and articles published through the center. We'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and for you to leave us a review so more people can discover our resources. On our website, we also have an opportunity for you to make a tax-deductible donation to support the ongoing work of the center. We always benefit from receiving questions and feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at ccl@moore.edu.au. As always, I would like to thank Moore College for its support of the Center for Christian Living, and to thank my assistant Karen Bielhartz for her work in editing and transcribing the episodes. The music for our podcast was generously provided by James West.